they came from out of town. It was a
new kind of neighborhood.
And the neighbors stared, but they didn't frown. New kind of neighborhood.
New kind of neighborhood.
Well, your friends were dancing on the lawn. It was a
new kind of neighborhood.
And no one stared like something's wrong. New kind of neighborhood. Oh, oh.
New kind of neighborhood.
Well, hello, Bikescapers. This is take three on this intro. I'm really getting tired. It's late at night here in San Francisco, past my bedtime. So I'm going to try and make this work. Let's see, last week we talked to James Howard Kunstler, the author of The Long Emergency, and we talked about peak oil and the nightmare scenarios that surround that. And this week, we're going to try and look at possibilities for the future beyond that. And so I went down to the park across from the big Safeway with a big garage underneath it. It used to be the ballpark where the San Francisco Seals used to play before they were the Giants. And I sat across the table from a picnic table there from Chris Carlson, author, historian, and co-founder of Critical Mass here in San Francisco. And I asked him, how did Critical Mass start? Originally, it was called the Commute Clot. What was it like when you first started that, and how did it create community in San Francisco? Here's Chris.
The Commute Clot was the first idea, and it was really born out of this notion of trying to get people to ride their bikes home together. You know, like there was a bunch of us who had been commuting on bikes for years and years. I'd been cycling already for 15 years in San Francisco. This is back in 1992 we're talking about. And the conditions on the roads were notoriously bad. There was no space in the road, no motorists who thought you had a right to be there, no real location for you to be in. You had to sort of know that nobody could see you, and it's kind of still like that to a great extent. But obviously, as more and more bicycles have filled the streets over the years, the sense of your rights on the road has expanded, and actually the courtesy shown us by motorists has really radically expanded. I notice a lot more courtesy from motorists today than I used to, and I think that's really a direct result of so many people seizing the streets on a regular basis and just really making it felt. But the origins of Critical Mass really grew out of that, a couple of different things. One was that isolated commuting experience, which really you're always somewhat isolated on a bicycle no matter what, but that really did help break that down because suddenly you had a rolling party with a bunch of people together. And little did anybody realize how much that was going to grab our imaginations and change our own view of what's possible in the world. And that was what was so exciting about it, was suddenly in large numbers. I mean, it started relatively modestly with about 48 or 52 or whatever it was people on the first ride. But those numbers grew pretty rapidly until by early February 03, we were up over a couple hundred. And then by October of 03, we hit 1,000. And then, you know, it ebbed and flowed since then. Hit probably...
93.
Yeah. Sorry, yeah, not 03. Long time ago. So, you know, that kind of magical, you know, unplanned growth of community that grew out of that, people coming together spontaneously because they could taste something good going on. And it was kind of what I've argued for this kind of experience, Critical Mass, and there's, I think, a number of other examples like this, is that it's something that's already in everybody's head. Like, you don't have to actually explain very much. It's like, get together once a month and ride home together, displace cars by filling the streets with bikes. It's just like, yeah, of course. Glad you said it out loud, because nobody'd said it out loud before. But it's not like a really unique idea. In fact, it's not even a new concept because it was done 100 years ago.
I was going to ask you about that.
Yeah, in the 1890s, there were thousands of bicycles in San Francisco, and it was the first great big craze.
That was before cars.
It was indeed. In fact, it directly set the stage for cars, which I think a lot of people tend to forget, and that might be something that we need to keep track of as we promote and engage with bicycling culture now, is what is it maybe going to lead to inadvertently. I don't actually know. I don't have any particular prognostications, but clearly the first time around, the 1890s, the big craze for cars and personal mobility, I mean, craze for bicycles and personal mobility led pretty directly to the cars, both in terms of the technological developments that made bicycles work better, pneumatic tubes, the exploitation of slave labor for rubber throughout the Third World,
the beginnings of mass production, industrialization, all those things for the bicycle turned out to be crucial ingredients for Fordism as we came to know it, and the car culture that predominates in North America and in other parts of the world as well. So,
yeah, I think the Wright brothers made bicycles too, didn't they?
Yeah. The plane has its origins in bicycle technology, and you know, there's a lot of interesting things to say about that. But that was a long, long time ago. And I think in terms of the contemporary era, what we found is that there's been this degradation of human community and human conviviality through the automobile culture and urbanization as we know it. That there's essentially been, except in certain areas, like San Francisco has a bunch of very nice neighborhoods still that are fun to be in, that you meet people on the street, that people talk to each other, which is less about the architecture of the neighborhoods and more about the people who live there. Similarly, Manhattan has some of that going on. Boston has certain neighborhoods, D.C., you know, Baltimore. Every city's got a place or several places that you know where you can find people who will actually talk to you, who will actually engage in human conversation, as opposed to just what's on TV or go, let's watch sports or whatever the other things that people do to fill up their time and space. So here in San Francisco, there's a kind of a critical mass of people, if you will, who are interested in something different, you know, some other way of being together in cities. And critical mass, the bicycle ride, caught that spirit and captured that imagination that, you know, very few things have managed to do. And so the origins of that at that time in the early 90s was a time when, you know, everything had been reduced, as it more or less still is, to buying and selling. People's engagement with each other is usually at the point of a transaction. Or as that movie Crash had it, at the point of a catastrophe, an accident. Then you get to talk to strangers and actually engage with them as human beings. But otherwise, we're alienated from each other. We hold these kind of weird ideas about each other, racist and otherwise. And it's very difficult to sort of have an expansive, generous attitude towards strangers and think of people as having something to offer you that might be interesting, might change how you think, might be really provocative and stimulating. And so instead of having this kind of narrow, frightened, withdrawn approach to life, which suburbia does so much to promote, in which you're supposed to stay home in front of your air conditioner and watch television and get the word from the man about what's really going on, which completely contradicts what you live. For a lot of people, I mean, the actual lived experience that one has in life is different than what we're told life is about from television and the spectacle. And yet people tend to trust the spectacle over their own experience over and over again. And that's what the bicycling has been an interesting thing for over sort of reversing that dynamic. People begin to trust their own experience more. They see things directly when they're out on a bicycle or on foot. I also want to endorse pedestrianism because that's even more intensely engaged with the street life of the city and the direct experience of what things are happening around you and engaging with other human beings that you may or may not already know and learning about their experiences and their perceptions and then developing a real sense of the world from actual lived experience as opposed to received, edited experience that mostly we get stuck with.
So how would you like to see critical mass sort of develop in the future, and how would it?
Well, people have asked that question for a lot of years, and I remember in the early days I used to be a pretty strong advocate of the idea of critical mass not needing to go beyond itself, that it's enough to maintain this space, to hold this kind of experience and keep it open for people to come to month after month. 13 years down the road, as we are now, one would have to say that may not be enough. You know, that actually it became rather institutionalized, not in the formal sense, but in the informal sense of being absolutely accepted. The police tried everything imaginable under the sun to break it up and stop it over the years, and they've given up a long time ago now.
Here in
San Francisco, yeah. And they just leave us to our own devices. And that's fine. That's good. I mean, it does have the interesting quality of providing newcomers and old fogies like us alike with a live experience in managing reality every time we go. We never know what's going to happen. Good things happen, bad things happen, crazy shit happens. We just don't know what to expect. And we have to deal. And, you know, it gets easy to be lazy when you've done it for years and years about not dealing. You know, like I know I mostly duck. Things happen. You know, I see somebody getting in a tussle, you know, either a bicycle, young guy on a bike is picking fights with people by riding into oncoming traffic completely unnecessarily and just being provocative, or people run into intersections way before the mass arrives to block traffic completely unnecessarily and totally contrary to my idea of what critical mass should be. But I don't really go and get in their face too much anymore. I used to.
I find that interesting because the last month or so there's been a lot of discussion on the email lists about mostly young people who were maybe 10 when Critical Mass started,
yeah,
or younger. And they're all concerned about the rowdies, what some people call the testosterone brigade, although some people have an objection to that language, but there's...
You do?
Yes, I've actually heard that.
By who?
Oh, I don't want to get into that.
Okay.
But there has been a lot of debate about it, and some people actually met, some mostly in their 20s, last Critical Mass at the front of the ride, and I promised to be there, and I was late, so I didn't... But I was sort of there, and I watched it happen, and... It was at least at the front of the ride. There were a lot of people that took it on as their own, and it was kind of interesting
that's good, because I mean that's the original internal self-description of the experience, is that nobody's in charge and you make it what you want it to be, and every month you have to reclaim that ownership and make it so. And you know, some of us did that for years, and we really were pretty dogged about insisting on certain cultural and ethical norms for the experience. Not that we managed to impose that absolutely, and of course there's always, you know, the frayed edges of any experience that tends to take on a quality of a mob. There's no authoritarian dictatorship here. You can do whatever you want out there, but you know, there's a lot of us who wish you wouldn't act like a creep, mm-hmm. and wouldn't make it worse for people on either side of the divide of riding bikes, whether you're pedestrians, bus riders, or car drivers. These are just average folks out in the street. They're not the enemy. They're our allies, and we need to win them over. And, you know, I think a lot of people at Critical Mass, especially in San Francisco, we really get that. And there's a big effort to be cheerful and friendly and thank people for waiting and express your, you know, gratitude for their patience, et cetera. But there's a few nutcases who show up month after month, and then there's these young guys who show up, usually guys, although there have been some women, who have a really kind of retarded sense of politics based on, I don't blame them, they're young, they're 20, they're 18, they're 25, I don't know how old they are, but they're obviously very young mentally in terms of their experience of politics, and so they tend to conflate their fantasies of class war, whatever those are, with a division between bicyclists and cars during Critical Mass, and imagine somehow that there's a class war going on between people in cars and people on bikes. This is completely, categorically false. And yet, that's the energy that they bring to bear. And, you know, you can definitely provoke fights with people on either side. I mean, there's plenty of motorists with a chip on their shoulder driving their SUVs and think that they own the road. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you surround that vehicle with a bunch of bicyclists, and some of them start pounding on the hood if the guys or the gal who's driving it inches into the crowd or whatever they do. Yeah, you know, there's a lot of room for people to go nuts, but let's congratulate ourselves. Nobody's ever been shot. Nobody's ever been stabbed. There's been very few actual fistfights, although there have been some. And there's been occasional times where cars got massively vandalized when they actually did something that was close to vehicular homicide or attempted vehicular homicide, I should say.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's times where bicyclists have asserted their own strength, and that's probably not a bad thing on balance, but I prefer when that doesn't get to that extent. It normally doesn't. The vast majority of people's experience on Critical Mass is joyful and friendly and fun, and it's really about this other way of inhabiting the cities. And so in terms of how could it grow from here, at this now that it's sort of stodgy and staid and stuck in its ways and repetitive and does the same thing month after month for all these years, I think that it's less about Critical Mass doing something different than about the people in Critical Mass finding ways of extending that logic. And the logic is one of withdrawal from the dominant social relations and a choice to, rather than contest the authority in society or contest the structure of life, to simply create a new one. And that's the beauty of Critical Mass, is it's still doing that. Just reading Jonathan Schell's The Unconquerable World, and it's a sort of a history of war and resistance, and deals a lot with the Klaus Witzian analysis of war and a total war. And then it deals with the arrival on the stage of the new players, which was, you know, mass society, the public opinion, the ability of people to engage with militarism without violence and actually defeat it. And that's happened a lot in the 20th century, in addition to all the barbarism and horror. And he's got a whole chapter on Satyagraha and Gandhi, who I normally kind of roll my eyes about. But as I was reading Jonathan Schell's descriptions of Gandhi and Satyagraha, I realized, well, this is Critical Mass exactly, because it's soul force. That's how the two words that he uses, and putting emphasis on each of those. Soul, got to have soul. We certainly have that in Critical Mass and as a community of bicyclists. And you got to have some force, which means not necessarily violence, but just fill the streets, be assertive, not back down, take your rights, take your space. And that's something that we've all learned to do both individually and together in Critical Mass. Mm-hmm.
And we've gone about this business of creating the world we want to live in now. We're not waiting around for somebody to change policies and make nice bike ways for us or anything like that. We just say, no, this is our city, and we're going to live in it the way we want to live in it, and we're going to do it right away. And so, you know, once a month we're allowed to. They've decided not to contest that, they being whoever the powers that be are that normally want to insist that the only way you can occupy the streets is in a motor vehicle. And so, and in fact, the power of a mass seizure of the streets month after month has even led them to make infrastructural changes, which, you know, the Bike Coalition takes all the credit for, and they certainly deserve credit for the hard, arduous work of sitting in meetings and arguing with politicians, which I don't wish on anyone. But the idea that they alone have created this infrastructural change in San Francisco, to me, is laughable. And that if there was not this mass seizure of the streets month after month by bicyclists, there would not be a political impetus for changing the city's infrastructure to accommodate bicycles. And so it's good that we keep doing that for that reason, if nothing else. But more than that, it's about creating the world you want to live in without getting permission, without asking for, you know, the politicians or the authorities to do it for you, which is, you know, kind of a classic leftist paradigm, is to complain and to appeal and make demands on somebody else, dad or otherwise, to make it right. And what we've managed to do, and it's not unique to us as bicyclists, it's actually kind of in the culture now to not wait around and not engage in old-style politics, but to do direct action, to do it now, just get on with it. And so you see that in all sorts of forms, you know, the bicycling culture being a very clear example of that. But there's also the phenomenon that people in this town did for last quarter of a century, which is taking over public lands and making community gardens. And
that's, I was going to bring that up. I was just thinking of Time's Up in New York. Yeah. If there are other focuses besides critical mass is the community gardens.
Yeah, and that's true actually everywhere. I was just reading this zine, because then again, I'm actually working on my chapter about bicycling right now for my book, and the DIY impetus, do it yourself, is so strong amongst this culture, and it's also the community gardening culture. It's also the open free software culture. You know, there's a bunch of different examples of it. The biodiesel movement is essentially a DIY home brewers phenomenon. You can argue about whether you think that's better or worse for the planet, or better or worse as a way of handling the questions of fuel. But in any case, it's clearly a lot of people think it's a good way to make an improvement, and they are going about doing that. And so there's something kind of beautiful about that. And I realized that I needed to trace back from where did this really start, because I had several of my interviews that I did around bicycling with this guy Ben Guzman, who's big involved with the Bike Kitchen in Los Angeles, as well as a somebody else. Oh, yeah, Martin Lugers, who does this CRUD, you know, Chopper Riding Urban Dwellers, which is a local club here in San Francisco, or local South Bay, too. And both of them used as an adjective punk rock to describe what they thought they were up to in terms of this other kind of value system. And I thought that was kind of interesting, because they're both in their early 30s. So when they were punk rock as a meaningful category got started when they were in their like 5 years old period.
It's the DIY ethic.
Yeah. And that's sort of the, and then the zine movement comes out of that. It started as fanzines, right? And so you have this incredible explosion of bicycle-related zines all over the country. I can't even begin to list them. There's so many. Every time I turn around, I'm finding out about another one. But I was just reading one from Minneapolis by a guy named Matt Resist. And, of course, the journal's called Resist. And the issue I was reading, which is, I think, dated from 2001 or 2002, it's about 80% about gardening and 20% about bicycling. And so there's a very common crossover, and a number of the interviews I've done with Ted White and Robin Havens and various people who've been really influential on the underground bicycle culture locally and nationally, they're equally have at least as much of a foot in the gardening world as they do in the bicycling world. And so,
if you believe Kunstler, the food is going to be an issue.
Well, that's why I think it's interesting, because if you think about
housing,
it,
too.
You think about it apart from sort of these ideological arguments, most of these people that do the bicycling scene or the gardening scene, they're really not going to give you a big political argument. They might say, oh, I want ecology to be better. You know, I'd like us to take better care of the planet, or some very easy softball, white bread kind of, brown bread, excuse me. version of ecological values, and that's all fine. There's nothing wrong with that. But the fact is they don't express themselves politically. They don't think of themselves particularly as political activists very often, maybe a little bit, but not super engaged. And in fact, what they're doing is they're going about this Satyagraha concept. They are making this other way of life, this post-petroleum, if you will, life, you know, which means you have to grow your food locally, you have to get around under your own power, you have to figure out ways to connect with your community and live in this place you are, and deal with another big issue, of course, is fresh water, and figuring out how to deal with gray water systems and rain catchment and changing the permeability of pavements and building green sewers and daylighting creeks. And all of these things speak to a radical ecological transformation of urban life. And the agenda is not stated by a political party, and it's not stated anywhere in one fell swoop, but it's everywhere. And it's everywhere in people's behaviors rather than in their ideology. It's percolating, it's coming to the surface as an ideology more and more, but it remains largely one of action. And you know, that's one of the problems of the American left, is it's or the anarchists, at least in North America, is their ideology is action. But in this case, these people are mostly anarchistic in as an adjective rather than as an ideology. You can describe what they're doing as anarchistic without them saying, yes, I'm an anarchist. And it's doing things without waiting for power to authorize or allow it. And that's great. You know, I mean, that gives us some hope. We don't really need to deal with on this other kind of level. And meanwhile, there's this technological revolution from below as well. You know, with permaculture, if you start looking at the work that's been done in permaculture for 25 years now, all this trial and error and all this amazing breakthroughs around how to really work with the logic of the biological planet and get both, you know, photosynthesis and water systems working with you rather than against you.
And, right, like trying to grow rice in the California Central Valley.
Yeah, there's a million examples. You know, I mean, just the whole, you know, making the desert bloom is such an asinine concept, not to mention planting subdivisions in it that require green European, not even European, just suburban American lawns and golf courses. It's just, this stuff is going to go. One way or the other, it's going to go. But it seems to me that it has as much chance of going out of a unplanned organic movement towards another way of living in your place that you are, that comes out of a whole bunch of people embracing a more authentic human way of living as opposed to merely being consumers of representations of living. And right. So people are sick of that. Most people, when you ask them very much, you know, scratch them a little bit, they're not very happy with their lives. They're certainly not happy living in a debt pyramid in which they're on the bottom and it's crushing them. And if they can figure a way out, they'll usually want to do it.
If they stop and think about it, they're kind of isolated. And they don't really get to hear.
Yeah.
They have to be validated by another person. And when you're sitting in a car on the freeway out in the sprawl land, it's kind of hard to.
Yeah, Rush Limbaugh's not going to validate you too much. Yeah. Or Michael Savage or any of those lunatics or their Christian nutcases either.
Yeah, I mean, that's why critical mass is so nice, because you realize you're no longer a Martian.
Yeah.
You know, you see others like yourself.
Yeah, you're an Earthling after all.
Yeah, it's a transformation of space, but it's also a transformation of inner space as well, you know, that way.
Yep, definitely, yeah. I mean, that's what I always would argue about why critical mass doesn't have to do something other than what it does, because it does change forever every individual's imagination whoever has participated in it, no matter what. You only have to do it once, and you will then, from then on, carry with you this actual tangible material experience of occupying the streets with hundreds, if not thousands, of other people on bicycles who are breathing and laughing and talking and sometimes singing, although not very often, but, you know, making various types of musical sounds. And it's a completely
displacing something else, like this big river of steel.
I mean, it's a, you know, you just notice the smells and the sound change completely in critical mass. It's not, you're not in a normal, you know, steel dominated urban environment or internal combustion dominated environment.
Lately, the music's been getting a little loud.
Yeah, I have that problem too.
But you know, maybe we're just old fogies. Yes.
I mean, I don't know. I always think that anything that makes it hard to talk is a mistake. And if, insofar as people bring sound systems to critical mass, I would like it if they could show some respect for the concept of conversation. And it's great to have music coming through, and sometimes it's fine if, you know, they could be pretty loud in a 5 to 10 foot radius. I don't mind that, because people who want to dance and be kind of party oriented, if they can go and get in that space with that music and do it, that's fine. But if one of those sound systems got so loud that it was filling the sound space for several hundred people. And that's too much. That's really objectionable to me.
It makes it hard to decide where we're going.
Well, it's not like that. I mean, you know, deciding where we're going, we don't really do. You know, whoever's on the
front. Just to talk about it. I mean,
yeah, I mean, if you wanted to, it would be hard. But it's also just like, you know, who wants to listen to one person's musical choice that loud for the whole, you know, the whole time?
Well, a lot of people like it.
Yeah. Good. Well, I have the same problem, you know, in every part of life. We live in a world in which I have my friend Matt Callahan recently published his book, The Trouble with Music. And one of the things he points out is that there's a great deal of sound out there that's really anti-music. And it's not about the you know, virtuosity of the musicians. It's not about the live experience of engaging with the creativity of it. It's just about consuming products. And unfortunately, a lot of that really loud, blasted music tends to fall into that category. Not all of it. I mean, there's a lot of really authentic raw punk rock and hip-hop and things that are really coming from below and don't get a mass market and need to be heard. But again, you know, I'm just not fond, as a guy in my late 40s, of people playing music so loud that you cannot do anything else but listen to it.
Right.
Because I don't want that. I want to have the choice.
Yeah. So we touched on transportation. I mean, it just is touchstones in this larger picture. Transportation, food, and I guess housing would be the third part of the triangle, as far as I'm concerned, unless it's a square or a rectangle or something. But
well, co-housing is something everybody fantasizes about, and you know, to some extent, people who get have the wherewithal to do so buy property and try to create, you know, communities and co-ops of housing, but it doesn't work very well. Private property seems to really sort of fly in the face of cooperation. And so as people get to own property, I mean, I had that experience in my life. I was a co-owner of a building with eight adults. I was one of the eight. And we were four couples, and all the couples broke up and all the friendships were destroyed. And it took about 10 years for that to fully be completed. But a lot of that happened really fast in the first 3 years. And, you know, it wasn't only about property, but that was a huge piece of the puzzle. It was definitely a major component of why those relationships degraded the way they did. And you know, just arguing about dumb things. You know, how big is a flower bed going to be? What size is, you know, what kind of laundry detergent can we share? Well, we couldn't share any because everybody had to have their brand. I mean, it was just ridiculous.
I think that was one of Kunstler's criticisms of when I broached the idea of bicycling as a community. And he said, well, you can't just organize a community around a hobby. You have to have something that has deep interdependence and interaction between the people. Mm-hmm. And you have to.
Well, that's right, and I think I would say that that's a good point from the point of view, if you agree with his idea that it's only a hobby. It's obviously more than that here in San Francisco and in a number of urban settings, Chicago, New York, Toronto, Montreal. There's a lot of people who have a much more than a hobby relationship to their choice of how to move through the city. It actually means a lot about their whole value system.
Well, and just as choosing to drive a car into the suburbs is going to have a big effect on the world.
Exactly. But I think it's difficult to begin to talk about organic communities growing up that are in isolation from what we do all day. Like, it's one thing to talk about how we choose to move through the city. That's a good thing, a good example of people making an intelligent choice that they make individually, and then it ends up being a social thing when they do critical mass. Then you have the choices of how to get your food and how to live and where to shop and what to buy and all that kind of stuff. That's all fine. But none of that will get very far unless we finally take up the really biggest public secret in America and around the world, which is, what do we do? Why do we do what we do? Vast majority of the work we do, in my opinion, is a waste of time, and nobody should do it.
Yeah, most of us are pixel pushers. We don't really create anything.
Yeah. Well, you know, we might be creating a beautiful document, or we might be creating a beautiful web page, or we might be creating, even in some cases, you might be making a really nice bed in that hotel, or you might be preparing a lovely meal and serving it with a great flourish at somebody's restaurant. But ultimately, we don't really have much choice as individuals in this democracy about what we do as a society. Like, we can make some choices individually and try to find less onerous rather than more onerous work. And most people will tend to gravitate in that direction. If you can get a better job for more money and less work, you'll generally go for that. And why not? That's fine. But it doesn't say anything about what you do, because the logic of it's all about the money and the time.
Well, as time passes and it becomes impossible to do what we do.
Well, there's that problem, too, is that we're living in an outsourcing world and on the verge of a large economic depression for all kinds of obvious reasons. And, you know, how long will we be able to live in this little bubble of prosperity that's based largely on the intense exploitation of the rest of the world? Who knows? You know, I mean, we're not going to have much to say about that one way or the other. I expect that historical events will far outflank us on that.
But in the meantime, we could be engaging, at least as our participation in that historical process, with a thoroughgoing inquiry into our own right as human beings who are thinking, alive people, to engage in work that should be done. Why should we do what we do? And there's all these other things that should be done that aren't going done, you know. And then you start looking at it seriously, and it's just incredibly out of whack. You know, how many things, like, just think about how much work it would take to do what we've been talking about here, the radical ecological transformation of urban living. That is an incredible amount of work. And it's a really intense process to analyze and make good decisions about resource use and allocation of labor and all that kind of stuff. Could we do it? Absolutely. Are we even having a conversation? Barely. You know, very few people even have the conversation. And it's always at the level of, oh, I personally will ride a bicycle to my community garden plot and I will just eat better.
Yeah, no.
And that's not enough.
Really hard to get a single little bike lane on the street or something.
Or work really hard to save a down payment to buy your own home so you can have an organic garden in the backyard. I understand it's a better choice to do that than not. But it's an inadequate choice for the kind of radical revolutionary transformation that we might really should be talking about. Mm-hmm. And that involves engaging with the aggregate division of labor and the aggregate use of resources that needs to be decided democratically, not by the free market, not by the unfree market that we actually live under, that gets to let people like Steven Bechtel and other, you know, giant executives make the decisions and the rest of us do what we're told. We need to be able to say, this is the work that we're going to do in our society to make life better, and it's going to guarantee that everybody gets their basic needs met, and not just here in San Francisco or here in the Bay Area or here in California, but actually across the planet. There's enough of everything for everybody if we decided to be smart about how to allocate our time and our resources. And that, so the ecological decisions that we get, or the ecological discussion that we have, that starts with a very mundane, basic choice to ride a bicycle, logically should lead to this much larger discussion about how to transform the global experience of engaging with the physical world. And that we should be making somehow democratic decisions about that as well as we can, which would mean logically devolving those decisions to the lowest point that they can be made. You know, this idea that supposedly once upon a time Republicans claimed to be in favor of that around, you know, how the United States system works, which is that decisions should get made at the lowest level possible. They obviously have completely reversed course a long time ago, and this was nothing but a facade. But in any case, I do think that a thoroughgoing and honest attempt to be democratic would involve those kinds of systems that would let you make decisions as locally as possible at every point along the way, but that would not leave anything outside of the realm of democratic decisions. Mm-hmm. So that everything we do would be subject to that kind of decision, like the choices of how the buses run, what we get to, how many hours we're going to spend doing some one thing or another, you know, how many spools of twine are going to be made this year, you know. Well, it's up to the twine makers to decide that, right? Obviously, but they might want to make more or less depending on how they engage with the other things that are going on. Like, are they getting the food they need? Maybe they need to spend more time growing food locally and make less twine, or, you know, steel bars or whatever the heck it is. So,
well, that sounds like an interview to me.
Fine.
Well, you came full circle. Well, thanks.
Sure.
It was really great to talk to you.
No problem.
Bicycles, roller skates, and you.
Well, that was Chris Carlson. Inspirational, yes. Well, what's going on in San Francisco this month? Let's see. Marin County, Marin Century, and Mount 10 Double Century. Not for me, but that's on August 6th, this Saturday. Marin Cyclist Bike Club invites you to participate in the ultimate Northern California Classic Marin Century Mount Tam Double and other endurance rides sponsored by their club. There are 4 ride options to choose from. So for more information, you can go to their website, which I can't read right here, but you can look on the show notes and it'll be there. Meteors in Marin Late Night Ride. We'll bike away from the city lights to Marin to catch the peak of the Perseid meteor shower. Bring front and rear lights, warm clothes, blankets and pillows, and of course hors d'oeuvres to share. Heavy fog cancels, because you just can't see that starry night. It's foggy. The ride is free for SFBC members, and non-members will be asked for a $5 donation. Contact Robin at bikeback.com. Robin at bikeback.com for more information. What else have we got? Oh, here's another interesting ride. The San Francisco Vertigo Bike Tour. This is on, 8:21 at 10:30 a.m. And it's going to go until about 11:30. It's just an hour long. How can that be? Well, that's what they have here. That could be wrong. Join Brandon Brunock and special guest Aaron Leventhal, author of Footsteps in the Fog, Alfred Hitchcock's San Francisco, as we ride our way through many scenes of what is arguably the most important San Francisco film ever made. That's arguable, I suppose. Alfred Hitchcock's Vertigo. We will stop at such scenic locations as Claude Lane, Mission Dolores, and the old Argosy Bookshop, where Aaron will discuss the movie and the importance of history behind its location. The ride will last approximately 3 hours and cover approximately 810 miles. How can that be possible? This is just so out of it. This is the Bicycle Coalition. I blame them for this bad information. But if you really want to get the real scoop, it's just call Brandon Brunock at dbarchitect.com. And if you didn't understand that, take a look at the show notes. It'll be there. There's of course Critical Mass on the 26th, last Friday of the month, foot of Market Street. And let's take a quick look at New York. There's a few interesting things going on there. Here's Senor Coconut. Tour de France. Podcast, the bad bicycle music podcast tonight. Let's see, in New York, movie night every Thursday at 8 p.m. August 11th, The Yes Men at the Time's Up Space at 49 East Houston between Mott and Mulberry. On August 5th, the next night, Friday at 10 p.m., the Central Park Moonlight Ride. They meet at Columbus Circle entrance to Central Park. And that sounds like a real gas. I always wanted to do that, but here I am out in San Francisco. Brooklyn Critical Mass with an after party in Red Hook is on Friday, August 12th at 7 p.m. Meet at Grand Army Plaza entrance to Prospect Park. And speaking of Prospect Park, there's the Prospect Park Moonlight Ride on Saturday, August 13th at 9 p.m. Same place, Grand Army Plaza entrance to Prospect Park. And this looks like fun. This is the Small Wheeled Bike Race, Sunday, August 14th at 2 p.m. Central Park at 72nd Street Transverse, Mid Park at Bethesda Terrace. And, boy, they got a lot of rides in New York this week. Also on August 14th, the Sunset Ride, Sunday, August 14th, 5 p.m. on the Brooklyn side of the Williamsburg Bridge. Oh, anything else? Oh, there's going to be a ride of silence honoring those who have fallen on their bikes. We don't like to concentrate on that gloomy stuff here on Bikescape, but that's Monday, August 15th at 7 p.m., Union Square South. So that's it for bicycle events. Send me your events. I'd love to get it out on the mail, out on the podcast, and I'm just totally inarticulate tonight. I'm so tired. But I want to get this done, get it out there and uploaded. shout outs. We got a shout out to somebody here. Oh, Steve in Scotland. Steve, you promised me some audio footage of Critical Mass Glasgow. Looking forward to that. New Bikescaper out there in Scotland. Anybody else write to me? Any other shout outs? Ames Chamberlain, I love you too. Who else? A lot of people have been writing lately. The podcast is getting around, and it's very exciting for me. So, everybody, enjoy your week. Take the lane. Drive your bike like it's a car, only better. And see you next week. Bye, everybody.